At the Races with Steve Bick. Horse racing, handicapping, interviews. This is At the Races with Steve Bick.
We're back, hour three, about 10 minutes in, and happy to be able to have John Adger visit. And the word that circulated yesterday, that Congaree at 22 had been euthanized, and you know, after earlier in the year having been pensioned as a stallion, really, when a horse of this magnitude passes, you get an outpouring of response. And that anybody that saw him run, anybody that bet him, anybody that, you know, watched really as he turned in one courageous performance after another, really a special horse. And certainly John and the McNairs knew it, because when they sold the entity of Stoner Side and the facilities and the brood mares and everything else, they held on to Congaree. John, good morning.
Good morning to you. Yeah, Congaree meant so much to not only Bob and Janice, but to just the entire Stoner Side team, and he had, and you're exactly right. He had lots of fans, and not the least of which is the great trainer Bob Baffert.
No doubt, and you know, I mentioned in introducing, you know, the discussion, I mean, going back, it's funny that one of the performances, if not, you know, the most remarkable performance of his career, it came in defeat, because his effort in the Derby, John, is, I mean, mind-boggling. I mean, people that understand race dynamics, what, you know, the effort he put in there, and you know, the way the race essentially collapsed, you know, for him to hold third, and, you know, only unable to withstand Monarcos and Invisible Ink late. It was spectacular. But then the rest of his career, he you know, won a hatful of grade ones, the two Cigar Miles. You were involved in every aspect of even creating Congaree. Talk a little bit about that, you know, that time for Stoner Side, and then, you know, the decision to retain him when the sale came to Sheikh Mo.
Well, in regard to where Congaree, the broodmare, came from, I was always, when I was a young man, I got to know Bob Bricken, who worked for Max Gluck, who owned Elmendorf, and back, as you well know, back in the, you know, the 60s and 70s, I mean, Elmendorf was just a tremendous force. And I always had a lot of respect for the broodmare band that they put together. And so when a friend of mine who was at least a couple of stallions from Mr. Cook here in Texas, when he was looking to maybe buy him, he asked me to give him some advice on it or talk to him about it. And I did. I said, by the way, the McNairs have a farm now in Kentucky, and find out if Mr. Cook is selling, he might want to sell the broodmare band. And I not knowing exactly what they had at the time. But anyway, long story short, they sent us the farm manager, who later became the farm manager of Stoner Side, Bobby Spaulding, sent a list of the 35 mares, and I think they were going to have 26 foals. This was in the winter of 1997, and one of the key mares was Mary Sheba, the who ultimately became the dam of Congaree. And we all, like most people, liked the great horse Arazi, and he had been moved from where Sheikh Mohammed had him, I think, over in Europe, and he had been moved to Three Chimneys. farm, and anyway, we bred the mare to Arazi, and the resultant foal was Congaree.
He was a big boy too.
He had 150 pounds. He had a foaling. He broke some ribs when he was foaled. He was a large foal, and then he became somewhat of the farm pet there because he was in the stall for several weeks. And Janice and Bob loved coming to the farm, and she started feeding him peppermints, and so from his whole life. In fact, I last time I saw Congaree was this past August. We had a horse sale in Texas, and I always would go up to, when I was up in that area, obviously go up to Valor to see Congaree, and all you had to do is to shake a little bag full of peppermints, and he could hear that sound. He knew knew the peppermints were close.
You mentioned Bobby and I don't think going back, it's probably 2 years now, when Mr. McNair passed, you were traveling and Bobby joined us and talked about Bob McNair, the development, who broke him and got him started?
Well, we had by then we had our training center,
right,
and down at Aiken, and we started out. The McNairs got in the horse business. I first met him met Bob in the fall of 1993. He had been trying to buy the Miami Dolphins, and that didn't work out. And then he was involved with when the NFL was having a expansion of two more teams. He was involved with the group that was trying to get one at St. Louis. So ultimately, the Rams moved there. But that didn't work out. So he and Janice always loved horses, and she was from a little town, Holly Hill, where I think Lucian Lauren, I think that's where Secretary was broken. And so Janice is quite an equestrian herself. So anyway, a mutual friend of ours, of Bob's and mine, introduced me to him, and he said, "Well, maybe I'd like to get involved with some thoroughbreds," and so that really started in the winter of 1994, and they had the first horse we bought for won $100,000 stake out at Golden Gate, and her name was Southern Truce. And then I introduced him to my dear friend Arthur Hancock, and he and Charlie owned a horse named Strode's Creek, and they had some offers on him. And anyway, long story short, we bought a piece of him, and they've been in the business 3 months, and all of a sudden they're in the paddock there at the Kentucky Derby, and they. Strode's Creek ends up running second, so we had a great run. And Bob made the comment. He said, "Now, John, I'm excited to buy a couple of horses with you, but I never want more than 10. I certainly don't want a farm." And I said, "Well, that's fine." And that fall, they end up buying a piece of Arthur Hancock's large acreage, which becomes Stonerside. So that's kind of how it all got started. And then we just had a great run of luck. I never could have worked for anybody as fabulous as they were. And still Janice, we talk all the time, but Bob was, I just give him he and Janice the utmost credit for all of this, because never would have happened without their not only they had the financial wherewithal, but they were really supportive. Even in you have a lot of ups and downs in this game, so they were the best.
When the negotiations, and you've told this story, actually, if I'm not mistaken, years ago with us, about how quickly the deal came together with Sheikh Mohammed, but what was the element that had Congaree excluded?
Well, they just wanted to keep, because Congaree was like a, you know, a member of the family, and he wasn't the only one they kept. We kept all the stallion interest that they had. They had quite a few interest in stallions. We did a lot of business with Lane's Inn, and they had shares in lots of stallions there in the Kentucky area, and then the ones they owned outright, like Congaree, and first stood him over to Dena Springs, and then he went up to Dr. Linwood O'Kane and his wife in New York at Standard Farm they had up there. And then we wanted to get him back to Texas. Bob always wanted to try to help Texas. So, and we did a lot of business with Will Farish. And so he had a wonderful farm called Lane's Inn, Texas, and he came mm-hmm. there. And then when Will sold it, we also were close friends with the Scarboroughs and Ken Carson, who manages Valor Farm. And so that's how he got there. But actually, the McNairs had brought the two leading stallions into Texas for the last, they've been leading stallions for about the last almost 20 years. And one was Valid Expectations, and he was leading sire for about 13 years. And then the present leading sire is Too Much Bling. We raced him, and Bob Baffert trained him for the McNairs.
Sure. Absolutely.
And so anyway, they liked that, and they had a later on. We sold to John Ferguson for Sheikh Mohammed was the farm and the training centers. We had already sold him the property there in Saratoga, the training center there.
Talk about his career, John, and some of the key moments, some of the favorite moments, because he kept fabulous company. I couldn't help but read off the names of the horses that beat him, because if he didn't win, he was losing to either a horse that was going to become a top sire, or somebody that that had plenty of resume associated with them. 12 wins, and I think four or five grade ones, including the two Cigar Miles. And he did it, he did it from, I guess the Carter was 7 furlongs, right? So from 7 furlongs to 1.25 miles.
That's right. We went up to, he had run in his first start. Bob had called me, and the colt, I tell you the truth. I was not right about that. The people that broke Congaree, I remember that now. We had just gotten a place at Aiken, but it was JB and Kevin McCathen.
The McCathens.
The McCathens. Down, and sure. They were doing work with Bob, and actually. We had bought. I had bought the filly. Bob allowed me to bid on the filly that became Chaluki, and we were successful in buying her. And Bob, of course, trained her. And then Bob McNair said, "Why don't you let maybe Bob Baffert pick out 4 or 5 yearlings and take them down, let them go to the McCathens." And so when we first learned that Congaree really had some talent, was that JB called me. That would have been that would have been about in 2000, and he said, "John, you still have the dam of this Arazi colt?" And I said, "We sure do. We hope she's going to be one of our better brood mares." I said, "Well, don't sell her. This is the fastest thing that's ever been down here." And that ended up, that was Congaree. And then Bob started him at Del Mar. He had a bad start, and which was unusual for him later on. And I think he finished sixth and kind of jammed his knee or something. And anyway, we gave him a little time off. And then as a three-year-old, he broke his maiden very handily at Santa Anita. And then he won a Lowndes race. And then Bob thought so much of him, he shipped him to New York, and he beat Monarcos in the Wood Memorial. And then on, so obviously that was a big day for us. And as you said about Aqueduct, he was undefeated at Aqueduct, and he won three grade ones. And then normally the Wood Memorial is a grade one, but for that year it was designated a grade two.
That's true, and you know, right now, and then right now again, at back down to the grade two. I had actually forgotten that there had been that period where the Wood went down to a grade two, then went back to a grade one, and then these last couple of years a grade two along with Bluegrass. But yeah, you know, he was murdered.
We won the race when it was. With Bob and John when it come back to a grade one then.
That's right. That's right. A couple of years later.
So, but anyway, then we went on to the, of course he ran a brilliant race in the Derby and gosh, I still look, watch the reruns. I still think we're second. I think, but at Invisible Ink, he must've beaten us by an inch or something for second. And Monarcos ran a brilliant race, obviously, and I think he still have the second fastest Derby?
Absolutely.
And it's my understanding, I think Congaree, I think co-holds the fastest mile split with another horse. I don't know if that's Spindlebuck or not. It may be, or I'm not sure about that, but. Anyway, I think he's right up there as far as the mile split. And then from there we went to the Preakness, and then we were third in the Preakness. His stablemate Point Given won it, and then we gave him some time, and he came back and won the pointed for the swaps, and he won that.
Which was a grade one at the time. And
it was a grade one at the time, exactly right. Mm-hmm.
And then it seemed, you know, after that Jim Dandy, and I'm sure I was there, but I had forgotten, because I remember Scorpion winning, but I don't remember much else about it. And, of course, around the same time, Point Given would have been over at the Haskell and then on to the Travers. But he was off at that point for the rest of the year and didn't come back until the next spring. He got hurt there.
Yeah, he got hurt in the we went back to the barn because he was a huge favorite, an odds-on favorite in the Jim Dandy. And Lucas, I think Wayne had two horses, and he won the race. Mm-hmm. And I forget the other one's name. But anyway, went back to the barn, and he had a problem with his knee. And by then, we did have our own training center, and we sent him down Tim Jones. He's a tremendous horseman and worked for Billy Mott, and he's one that kind of took care of Cigar. And he ran the training center, and then he got him back after several months, and he went on to Bob, and he had a good year, you know, as late in his 4-year-old year.
Now, at that point, you know, now you're just looking to, you know, build a resume, and what really is amazing, John, when you look through, you know, these assignments, he really moved smoothly through, you know, all these distances. We mentioned the Carter at 7/8, the Hollywood Gold Cup at a mile and a quarter. Bob wasn't afraid to ship him around, and the two. It's funny, the Met. I don't know what it was, but the Met. It didn't go well at all, and I don't know how much of that was wet track. I mean, was that a consideration?
Well,
he did win on a wet track.
Yeah, I think Gary Stevens wrote him, and they were, I think, frankly, a miscommunications there with he and Bob or something. I'm not sure exactly, but that was a huge disappointment because we had, you know, won the Carter and thought we were in good shape to win that, and it was just one of those days, but he came back. He came back after that, and then we finished up with him. I'm trying to get my. I don't have anything in front of me right
now. Well, the Gold Cup. Well, he got a little freshening.
Right.
Yeah, he got 60 days.
We got that's exactly right. Then we won that, and which was really meant a lot to him because that showed people he could win at a mile and a quarter, and then I'll never forget what Bobby Frankel said to me in the Breeders' Cup Classic, I believe it was that year at Santa Anita. We had beaten, I think, Pleasantly Perfect every time we had run against him. And I'll never forget after the race, Bobby had Medaglia d'Oro in there. And Bobby also trained for Sunnerside. And he said to me a few days after that, he said, you know, John, if we hadn't been in the race, you guys are going to win it. And if you hadn't been, we're going to win it. Because they hooked up and probably ran head and head for probably close to, you know, 7/8 of a mile.
Now, after the Gold Cup, just got nipped by Perfect Drift. One of the rare times where Perfect Drift was willing to put his nose in front, right at the wire, and. You mentioned Pleasantly Perfect, of course, in the Classic, but then he came back after the Classic to, you know, to win another Cigar Mile. And in fact, we've got that race. We're going to listen to it to appreciate. This was a powerhouse performance too. Ended up being his last career win.
Right.
Because he, you know, and actually, before we listen to this, John. Talk about that for a second, because rather than make arrangements and send him to stud, he did come back and try the San Antonio and then the Churchill Downs handicap, the 7/8 race.
Right. You're right. We were going to bring him back. We thought we just ran the McNairs. They love the horse so much. And as long as he was sound and everything, they really, it was a super thrill for them or anybody really that has a horse like a Congaree. You want to see him run, and so we had thought about retiring him, but they said, well, look, if he's still happy and he's sound, let's try him as a 6-year old. So that's what happened, and then,
wow.
Then we ran in that race. Bob was getting together that the Churchill Downs race was on Derby Day, isn't it?
Yeah.
It was that, you know, Derby weekend, and Spicetown won it, I think.
He did. He absolutely did. And
And of course, he's an outstanding horse. And Congaree, that was the end of the road there as far as racing.
Well, really a brilliant career, 12 wins, 25 starts, 2 seconds, 4 thirds, and really, acquitted himself in every assignment. Even when he tried the turf in that Oak Tree Mile, he didn't run badly. He got beat 3 lengths, he seemed to handle it. And in fact, the maiden breaker, I had forgotten this, John, before I pulled up the career. I'd forgotten that he broke his maiden in an off the turf event.
Yeah, that's right. We're at Santa Anita, wasn't it?
It was, absolutely, absolutely.
Yeah,
that
yeah.
Came.
Yeah, I think if I'm not mistaken, he broke his maiden there, and then he ended up running. Let's see, he ended up there, and then he came back and won won a Lance race.
Yeah.
And if that, I think that was the same day that Point Given won. I'm not sure if it was a San Felipe or what. He won something that day. Because didn't he run in the Santa Anita Derby or not?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah.
And so that Bob had to separate.
As I said, they were, that's right. Exactly right. They were stablemates. And then, in fact, Point Given, I believe, was the favorite for the Derby.
Sure. Absolutely. Absolutely so. Was. Well, you know, if it wasn't for Minarcos's remarkable effort, it could have been a situation, you know, that we would have talked about for years later about, you know, Baffert's other horse, winning potentially a Derby, because, it was, and, you know, nobody really realized it at the time, but, you know, Baffert was struggling with the hoof on Point Given that, you know, bothered him, you know, really all year. But, John, Congaree, for whatever reason, and I suppose, you know, because people are so focused on three-year-old accomplishments, he deserves way more appreciation than he seems to get. When discussion of the era, the first, call it the first decade, you know, or the last 25 years, however people talk about horses, he absolutely deserves mention as one of the best horses of his generation.
Well, that's awful kind of you. We really think so, and some professional like you can really see that. And I totally agree with you. He showed up. I tell you one thing: you put him in a race. That's what Bob loved about him. He would show up, and he was a neat thing about him. He was such a kind horse and fun horse to be around. He had a really real personality, and I'll tell you another funny. You have just a minute.
Sure, go ahead.
Funny little story. You'll get a kick out of this. I was already up in New York to be with Bob for a couple of days. I'm talking about Bob Baffert, and Bob McNair had a group of guys playing golf at a club he was a member of called Pine Valley, and so they come over to the race, and we're all there, and we win. We go back to the go. This was. Let's see. All right, so that was 2001. He didn't start playing. The Texans didn't start playing football until the next year, 2002. And he says one of his friends, a fellow named John Butler, who's really a funny guy, and Bob's feeding him. I had some peppermints for him to give Congaree, and he's feeding him the peppermints. And John says, "Bob, I'll tell you one thing. When that wide receiver catches a touchdown pass to get you in the playoffs, he's going to want a heck of a lot more than a peppermint."
That's a fair assessment.
So that's what Bob said. Bob said, "You're right about that, John."
I love it. We're going to listen. John Adger's with us, and of course, John managed the operation for the McNairs, and amazing success. I mean, the success of Stoner Side. I mean, it seemed for that period, that that white jacket with the, with the green stripe, not stripe, that's the sort of a chevron.
Chevron.
Yeah, sure, yeah, and it became so familiar, and it was one of my favorites right away when I was, getting immersed into the game. We're going to listen to the second Cigar Mile win, and one thing that was fun about this was the voice that you're going to hear, because this goes back to 2003, and John Imbrial had already started the winter season. When I pulled up the audio, I was surprised not to hear Tom Durkin. Sometimes Durkin would hang around after Breeders' Cup, but this is John Imbrial calling Congaree's second Cigar Mile win. Jerry Bailey aboard. Let's listen.
And we're off in the Cigar Mile. Well fancied, out for the lead. A well fancied in front early as they race up the chute. Congaree broke well in between horses. Down on the inside is a Midas Eyes. On the outside, it's Tuckett and Bowman's Band and New York Hero. A tightly packed bunch as they move up the backstretch. Well Fancy leads by a head. A Midas Eyes at the rail and Congaree in between. The opening quarter in 22 4/5 seconds. Midas Eyes has now taken over. Midas Eyes by 3/4 of a length. Congaree and Well Fancied head apart second and third, with Tuckett racing in fourth. Bowman's Band, Extreme Outside. Then it's Voodoo and New York Hero. Midas Eyes leads by a half length as Congaree gets a bit closer. The opening half mile, 44 2. Around the far turn, Midas Eyes in front. Congaree second. Tuckett is moving up on the outside of Well Fancied. Then it's a Bowman's Band, followed by Voodoo and New York Hero. And they're coming for the quarter pole. It's still Midas Eyes on the inside under the left-handed whip. Congaree on the outside. Congaree now puts his head in front. Midas Eyes battles back. 3/4 1/108 3. Congaree in front now by 3/4 of a length. Midas Eyes in second. Farther back, it's Tuckett and Bowman's Band. And now Congaree is getting clear. Congaree is going to make it 2 years in a row in winning the Cigar Mile. And what a day for Jerry Bailey. He's won all three stakes. Congaree, the winner here.
There it is.
Boy, that certainly made my day. I tell you, listening to that. And what a horse. So.
Well, this was a huge performance. And, people forget, John, that... Yeah, that he was a champion sprinter. One of those horses that really could do a lot of different things.
Right. No, he really was. He was a super talent, and you know, you just if you're lucky enough to be in the game and get, and you've got to, like Bob McNair says, what we try to do at Stoner Side is position ourselves so luck will run over us.
that's a good line,
and we sure did. Thanks to him, I could give all the credit to my boss. I tell you.
Well, the McNairs were missed immediately. They burned like a comet of sorts, right, John, into the game.
What's that now? They did what?
Kind of a comet. I mean, how many years?
Yeah.
How many years did they?
Well, from the time that we started, it was just shy of 15 years. We started. You'd have to say the first horse we bought was in January of I believe it was in towards the end of January of 1994, and we closed the deal with Sheikh Mohammed on October the 6th. October the 6th of 2008. And what I'm most proud of is I'm a big believer a good deal is when it's good for both parties. And Sheikh Mohammed had been, and through John Ferguson, had been just a great backer of Stoner Side. When, you know, we sold lots of horses to him over the years, but what I was most proud of was that 3 weeks after they wired the funds, the two of the horses that we just were in the package sold to them. One was Raven's Pass, who won the Classic, and with John Gosden training, and the other one was Midshipman, that Bob Baffert trained, who won the Juvenile, and of course both of them became champions.
Absolutely. So they benefited, and they continue to benefit. In fact, and you mentioned the likes of Midshipman and the Brood Mares. You know, you still see plenty of them, and then Bob and Janice got to enjoy, and you and the rest of the team. Add Bobby Spaulding as well, who's
well, absolutely.
You know, now running the operation for Jane Lyon,
and then a lot of the Vicky Van Camp and a lot of the people that worked for him, but they all had a job with I guess it was called Darley back then, and then
sure.
Now Skadolphin, and so we're proud. I tell people, I said Dan Pride and Jimmy Bell who run get off, and I say, outside of you guys, I'm your biggest cheerleader.
I love
seeing those old Stoner Side families still perking up there for them.
Well, John, I wasn't going to let Congaree's passing go without a visit, and I appreciate
it very much. Well, you're so kind to do this, and I'll tell Janice McNair today.
Please.
We had this conversation, and what you're going to, she'll be so pleased.
Well, John Adger, everybody, Stoner Side, The Legacy, and Congaree 22. And anybody that saw him run live or in person or bet on him, you always got your money's worth. John, be well. Best wishes for the holidays and a healthy, happy new year.
Okay. Same to you. Thank you very much, Steve.
Not at all. John Adger.
Really appreciate it. Thank you.
Bye-bye. It's our pleasure. Here we go, John Adger. And standing by, we got about a little under 15 to close out. And we started the morning talking about Congaree and Dick Allen. And we'll close out talking about Congaree and Dick Allen. Dick Girardi, nice enough to join us in Philadelphia. And even though Dick Allen, you know, predated Dick's sports writing in Philly, certainly cast a long shadow. And then, of course, you fold in Dick and his brother Hank and the racing experience and, you know, lots to appreciate. Dick, good morning.
Good morning, Steve.
You know, Dick, I think I was pretty pointed, actually, opening the show talking about, you know, Dick Allen and, you know, who obviously when I was a kid was a tremendous star. And, you know, then not that I got to know him, but I got to talk to him once, and I would send him pictures from Pimlico when I was covering, you know, Preakness, and send him pictures of his brother and their horses, Sparrow One and Northern Wolf. And he would always text me back. And, a fascinating athlete, and personality that, was not an easy person to, understand, not an easy person to, you know, pigeonhole, and you know, probably suffered because of it.
Yeah, I don't think there's any doubt. I mean, look, I've talked to some older sports writer friends of mine, unfortunately, who've since passed away, who told me stories about Dick Allen's time with the Phillies. Obviously, he was the Rookie of the Year in '64, and you know, an MVP later for the White Sox, and certainly one of the great players of his era. And I knew his brother Hank a little bit. Steve, as you know, I grew up in Baltimore and went to all the Maryland tracks. That's way before I ever came to Philly. And I knew Hank when he was a trainer. Good dude, good guy to hang out with. And I certainly saw Dick a number of times at different racetracks. And he was from Wampum, PA, which is, I don't know, 50 miles or so outside of Pittsburgh. But, man, he and his family, they loved the track. And as they, I know you and I were texting back and forth last night, as a baseball player from the mid-60s to the mid-70s, Dick was one of the great stars of the sport. He was younger than, like, Hank Aaron and Frank Robinson, Willie Mays, Roberto Clemente. They preceded him. But in that decade, he was every bit as good as they were. And they were among the greatest players in the history of the sport. Yet, for some unknown reason, he is not yet in baseball's Hall of Fame. And it's just a tremendous oversight, because clearly he should be.
I made the point that, you know, the racetrack and so many horse players and fans and people around the game, I saw, you know, just in the last 24 hours, it's not even 24 hours yet, about how many people who said, I used to see him at Delaware Park. Used to see him at Laurel. I'd see him at Philly. And, you know, the racetrack, seemingly a much more comfortable setting, you know, for him. The legacy, and there's so much that's being written, and I know there's going to be more, Dick. The problem we have is that I don't sense that there's sports writers around that can kind of revisit what might have been their own misreading and misunderstanding of him. You know, if you go back to the 60s and, you know, his resentment of being called, you know, quite frankly, a boy's name. And I basically invoked the word, you know, from that era where people viewed him as uppity, which is about as disgusting and condescending. And I think that that contributed mightily to the fact that he was excluded from one vote after another, the baseball writers.
Yeah, Steve, I think you're right. Look, I obviously I wasn't around. I didn't get to see him play. But I think that's exactly right. The terms that you used were disgusting in every way. I think he was a victim of the times. He was a shy guy, but anybody that actually took the time to get to know him, and again, I didn't, but I know people that did, they loved him. I mean, he was just a wonderful guy. If you listen to some of the teammates that played with him, Mike Schmidt said he's like his favorite teammate ever. Alan came like late in his career, early in Mike's career. Steve Stone, I saw, was on Twitter yesterday, the great pitcher who's been a longtime broadcaster in Chicago, just talked about what a great teammate he was. Goose Gossett said he's the best player ever played with. And think about who Goose Gossett played with on some of those great Yankee teams. So, yeah, it's really unfortunate. It was just the times. It was the mid-60s, and the world was changing. The Civil Rights Act came about, and people just, and it's really sad in a way, because there's just so many people that didn't understand. But the good news is his story has gotten out over time. But hopefully what will happen, he's now in the Veterans Committee, obviously at the Hall of Fame. And hopefully someday, it won't be a sports writers thing, because it'll be a group of people, all ball players. And I'm not sure who's on that committee, but certainly for his family and the people, certainly in Philadelphia and Chicago that watched him play, would love to see him in. And for a guy, and you're right, I'd like to, I can't count how many times I saw him at various racetracks through the years. I think I probably went up and talked to him, but I have a great memory, but by all accounts, he was incredibly approachable and loved the track. And who among us who loves the racetrack can't be a great person?
Well, exactly. And, you mentioned the, you know, this group that meets every 5 years now, part of the hall. It just so happens that, you know, I subscribed to the Inquirer online, and there was literally 4 days ago, it must have been Friday or Thursday, there was a piece by Matt Breen. I sent you the link. Matt Breen wrote an amazing piece on Allen's interests, and there's a guy in Philadelphia they've got those video billboards that have been running, and they were basically, you know, trying to create some momentum against that committee, and now they're saying the committee decided just I guess in recent days that they're putting off their 5-year meeting until next December now, because they have to do it in person for some reason. But there's a guy by the name of Mark Carfagno in Philadelphia that was on the Veterans Stadium grounds crew, and has been championing Dick Allen's cause for the hall. And you know, I related this, Dick, to the situation with certain, you know, trainers and jockeys that are being, you know, put off for our hall. I mean, what would it, how do we know that if Garrett Gomez hadn't been put in on time, that it might have literally saved his life, for all we know?
Yeah, no, it's a great point. Yeah, the guy you're talking about, Mark Carfagno, a.k.a. Froggy. And, yeah, I think of some people in horse racing. I mean, what in the world, you know, who was waiting to put Craig Perrett in the Hall of Fame?
Uh-huh.
I mean, it took forever to get Craig in. And, yeah, look, I know Craig since he wrote that twice, and he's one of the all-time greats. But, yeah, for some reason, there's just some people that get overlooked. And it's just I can't explain it. And there is a chance still to right the wrong for Dick Allen. But, yeah, you would just – the fact that the committee wouldn't meet virtually, and now, of course, he's gone. But, yeah, it's obviously could have been much better if he could have been in Cooperstown when it happened and his family could have been there with him. But, you know, hopefully someday. I think he missed by one vote in the committee several years ago.
Correct.
Just unfortunate because, again, for baseball people, and they're a lot like horse racing people, you look at numbers, you look at accomplishments, man, you look at him on Baseball Reference, and I knew you and I were texting about it last night. It's unbelievable the numbers he put up for a long period of time.
Well, the other players apparently that are also waiting, a couple that have been, gone for many years, that are in the group that are apparently under consideration, Gil Hodges, who, my God, has been dead for 35 years, and Minnie Minoso. However, Jim Catt and Maury Wills and Tony Oliva, I mean, compared to some of the chazarai that's been put in this stupid Hall of Fame, for them to not be in, I'll tell you the other guy that they absolutely mistreated, and the arrogance that held off Orlando Cepeda because he had a marijuana call. I mean. It's disgusting, and this really bothered me yesterday because I felt like I had some sort of connection just because we followed each other on Twitter and I could text Dick Allen, he would text me back, and I told the story about when I tried to get him on the show, Dick, and he called me a couple of days later. And I literally, when I looked down and I saw Dick Allen, the phone ringing, I mean, I was driving. I told Tina, I got to pull over. And I talked. I mean, I was so excited. Literally one of those baseball gods that you have growing up.
Yeah, I mean, look, that's the reality of it. Look, when we were kids, we all had our idols. Look, my growing up in Baltimore were, the great Lenny Moore, the running back, receiver, Johnny U. Those are my guys. Brooks Robinson, Frank Robinson. Hell, I used to sit out in the right field bleachers of Memorial Stadium, talk to Frank Robinson in between innings. I mean, because it was on by 85 cents. So, yeah, I know where you're coming from. I get it. So you obviously are always going to hold your youthful heroes in the memory bank, no doubt.
Well, and then, as I got involved in racing and to find he and Hank and his brother Ron and the three of them, that worked on the shed row. I'm going to put up a picture, Dick, in today's listing of him on his pony Blaze that you're just going to love. It's fabulous. You're going to just love it.
Yeah, great people, great family. And yeah, they certainly love the racetrack, and I always love seeing them at the track.
Dick Girardi, everybody, and we went through a conversation. We haven't even talked about the crappy timing going on with this stupid timing system. We'll save that for next visit.
You got it, Steve. It's always great talking to you.
Dick Girardi, everybody. Actually, this week we do have to bring that up. They're still having troubles with this GPS system. I want to thank Dick. We had to pay tribute to Dick Allen and Dick Powell earlier as we talked to Hong Kong, and John Adger to remember Congaree, Ed DeRosa to get you ready for tomorrow's Turfway Pick 5 carryover, and Chris Hartman started us off way back when this morning. Going to take a look. The sale is about an hour underway at Timonium, so see how that goes. We'll talk about it tomorrow. Andy Serling tomorrow, Sid Fernando, and more. Good luck if you're playing today, everybody. Talk to you in the morning at the races.
The latest racing news. It's At the Races with Steve Vick on Sirius XM Radio.
The exciting Southern California Thoroughbred Daytime Racing Circuit continues with the LA County Fair Meet at Los Alamitos Racecourse. The meet is off to a great start with strong fields through.
There's a great story to tell in Pennsylvania. Only three states have produced more Breeders' Cup champions, and no state can match our performance in recent years. Since 2016, our numbers of mares bred has skyrocketed, unlike the national trend. And this year's live foal report shows Pennsylvania up over 50%. Why? Our incentives and bonuses are the best in North America. Please visit us at pabred.com and see why Pennsylvania is the premier place to breed and race.